Okay, so I'm going to be talking about Barbara Guest and a couple of her two poems from different ends of her career, which were entitled Colonial Hours. And this is part of a longer project on verbal and visual abstraction. And one of the chapters of this project will focus on Guest and on Marjorie Welch. This starts, appropriately enough, with a quote from a 1978 radio interview between Susan Howe and Barbara Guest, which was found on Sound, so that's Penn Sound. Okay, so in a 1978 radio interview with Susan Howe, Barbara Guest reads several passages from her novel Seeking Air. One is set in Jamaica, and of this she remarks, "I've never traced the reason for it. I'm fascinated by colonial life. That's really what interested me in the Caribbean, not contemporary life at all. I'm fascinated by India and the colonial life there. I want to hear about those Victorian houses and what they did in the summertime, what really went on in the Himalayas." Okay, so I think about sort of misty hill stations and so on. And Howe asks whether it is the colonial experience per se that interests her, not say the English in India or Spanish in Florida or something very specific. Guest agrees, saying, adding also, people who are cut off in space. And thinking about space is one of the things I'm going to try and do in the course of this paper. So I want to put a little pressure on this term colonial. It could not, on the face of it, be more out of keeping with the imperatives of our own time. In the Caribbean sequence in Seeking Air, we hear of my imaginary planter's life. Rum is drunk by the sophisticates who people the novel. Baked snapper, mangoes, coconut ice cream are eaten. And this depiction of the colonial, it seems from where we're standing in our time, seems to be an unsalvageable slice of Orientalism. It's, on the face of it, a furniture shop sensibility, a point that Guest perhaps acknowledges with the narrator's looking at that planter's shares in the department store, the shares with its dark leather cushions and oiled wood. Okay, so there was a shop called Lombok on top of Court Road until about 10 years ago, which specialised in colonial furniture, colonial ambiences, and for me that there's a touch of that to this aspect of Seeking Air. Now, what to do about this? References to Jean Rhys's White Side SOC, to Adele Ugo's Journal of Madness in Barbados suggest an attention to marginal female experience in the novel. But questions of gendered redress do not eclipse the apparent lack of attention to the exploitation that facilitates the lives of white Europeans, whether in the Caribbean, the US, or India. So I want to approach these issues obliquely through the question of the qualities of abstraction, atmosphere, and texture in Guest writing. By texture, I mean not only the materiality of her meticulously sounded poems, but the natural play of meaning in the construction of atmosphere. And I do not propose simply to equate abstraction with the non-referential axes of language, the visual and the sonic, or to set abstraction against the referential. I will be interested in the referential too, how meaning can be put to abstract ends. The specificity of the texture, not proliferating textuality, is my focus. And this way I hope to unpick some of the meanings of the colonial in the work. The German philosopher Gernot Bermer has written extensively on the aesthetics of atmospheres. He describes a turn away from a language-based model of aesthetic meaning. He writes, nobody understands by Mona Lisa the person Mona Lisa, but the painting. And it is this which is experienced. Painting does not refer to its meaning as a sign, a meaning which could only be thought. The painting is, in a certain sense, what it itself represents. That is, the represented is present in and through the painting. Of course, we can also read and interpret such a painting, but this means cutting out or even denying the experience of the presence of the represented, namely the atmosphere of the painting. This is very helpful up to a point in that it turns our attention away from the meaning per se of an artwork towards a more experiential encounter with it. However, when it comes to poetry, Bermer's aesthetics have very little to say about the extraordinary interactions between what he calls meaning as a sign and non-meaning. And I think that relationship is very important in literary artworks such as Guest's. So So this, in other words, is writing that uses the inescapably semantic meaning of language to ends that are neither conventionally referential nor indeterminate. My choice of the word texture is a way of comprehending the cohesiveness of this writing. I think it's this really interesting question of voice in Gadsden, that she writes in lots of different modes, but there's a very Gadsdian sort of signature, nonetheless, that persists despite the many different kinds of discontinuities she explores in her writing. So the poetry often invokes atmospheres encountered in the works of others. She may use an author's name, for example, or deploy a loosely medieval trope, or use vocabulary that belongs to an identifiable literary mise-en-scène. Elsewhere, she thumbnails scenes that appear to have no literary precedent. All of these gestures are typically glancing and fragmentary. Just a few words suffices to open a door into a different space, but typically this space dissolves just as quickly. Critic Robert Bennett notes that the narrator of Guest's novel, Seeking Air, describes literature as the destruction of space. He goes on to assert that the critical deconstruction of spatial forms constitutes a crucial dimension of Guest's notion of what it means to write, and that many readers find her ambiguous spatial images especially unsettling, partly because they're traditionally accustomed to think of spaces as a privileged ground of stable meaning. I agree, but I think these points about space apply equally to time. I also think that Guest's destruction works better than Bennett's deconstruction. Again and again in Guest's work, fleeting representations of other spaces and times dissolve into verbal textures, leaving nothing more tangible at the level of the poet than atmosphere. Guest had no settled home as a child. She lived at times with her aunt and uncle and with her grandparents. But she spent part of her early childhood living with her parents on the eastern coast of Florida. In his introduction to the collected poems, Peter Gizzi writes, "Perhaps the indeterminacy and expansiveness of her voice were an answer to the necessity of establishing a lived space within the work of art." I'd agree, so long as that lived space is striving to be comfortable with displacement rather than some kind of settled home. As Gizzi also remarks, she would find herself she would find herself at home in modernism, leaving modernity as one of the sort of something she becomes melancholic and sad about in later life. Perhaps the ambivalence towards being cut off in space is here, but how can we find an accommodation between the rich spatio-temporal errancy of Guest's imagination and the compromised, barricaded lives of white colonials? Guest entitled two poems Colonial Hours. One appeared in 1968's The Blue Stairs, and another in 2002's Miniatures of Other Poets. Introducing the earlier of these two poems from 1969 reading at the Library of Congress, Mexico, and South, she says that it is again part of this Caribbean, Florida, Peninsula thought of mine. And that's really interesting that she thinks about Florida looking outwards towards the Caribbean rather than inwards towards the rest of the United States. And her early series, Open Skies, is certainly Floridian in atmosphere. It's reminiscent of the bleached out seaside scenes of H.D.'s first book, Sea Gardens. First Colonial Hours poem sets up a phantasmagorical representation of the Caribbean. So we've got land in the wake of Prospero. The poem hosts night temples of psalm, of palms. Night temples of palms, coral walls, ceiling fans, hibiscus, a stockade, and palmetto and cane. Timothy Gray, in his book Urban Pastoral, reads the poem in the context of Guest's childhood experience in coastal Florida, but such terms, Prospero, palms, palmetto, and cane, such terms surely locate the poem's sensibility and idea. In the poem, spatial things don't resolve. Internal and external body and environment interpenetrate. So we have the machinery of coral walls, your bamboo crest, the stockade that encircles you, and you are a porch with screens. The poem inhabits several modes, a mixed, as it Progressive Campaign. So it's just going to look at three stanzas. Rhapsody of Helmet, it also chants, a head burden to catch some granaries. Legacies, the sea strokes up, dried as weed cemetery, or blue ballooning stingrees thrown. Night temples of palms, the rain blows tropique as ceiling fans. You go in your orphan feet, crossing the tiles. You are two sinister people in your oleander suit, your scorpion shoes, your eyeglasses ground from sand. So the first of these stanzas is discontinuous, resistant to sense making, even at the level of the phrase. What can be meant by rhapsody of helmet or sun granaries? The second, a tropical space of rain, towering palms, collapses into an interior space. And in the third, Guest is writing, to use her phrase, in the shadow of surrealism. Nature is assimilated to clothing in the oleander suit, the scorpion shoes. It's almost like we're in Lunar and Carrington territory. Then we have the wild, the luxurious birds, an exotic trope. But their scream is like yours when you fear the cold. What of the cry of another, less glamorous bird, the tern? We have the colonial language of tern sibilancy. The colonial language of tern sibilancy. Okay, so we've got this heavyweight term, colonial language, and then it's aligned with the tern. And I've investigated, terns are not remotely sibilant. This is a species of tern. It's the only one that's native to the Caribbean. Powerfully resonant historical phenomenon, colonial language, but she does it with an unglossable term. It's a gesture of willed inarticulacy. Perhaps that's the point. Okay, so the ending of that poem. Okay. Here's how that poem ends. Today you sit on the cropped grass, today looking at the map, you blink, magnified world, at my education, my craft, my fruit, my oranges. It's hard to calibrate the degree of irony in this claim to ownership of interwoven strands of culture capital. What happens in the shift from you to my? Who's speaking? Perhaps it doesn't matter. What matters is the atmosphere that's presented to the reader. Nature organized by human operations and human perceptions. Education, cartography, exploitation of natural resources, all are bound up in the imposition of economic and cultural imperatives. Power is at issue in this colonial writing, but it's a sensuous, sinuous, multivalent power that cannot simply be assimilated to a colonizing act of capture. It's not possible to identify, in other words, whether such lines are symptoms or diagnosis of colonial ills. As Guest observes, these are ghosts, not words. In an interview with Kathy Wagner, Guest remarks, all poems are full of real and fictive places. I certainly wouldn't want to write a poem about a real place all by itself. Okay, I think that's quite a helpful thought. So she aligns in this interview the poem's interiority with, as she calls it, with metaphysics. And that is aligned in terms of fictive. So interiority, metaphysics, fictive, on one hand. And then exteriority with appearances, the real. Okay, exteriority, appearances, the real. And it's interesting that in her writing about her writing and her comments and interviews, she's often trying to sort of balance, she has these kind of dyads that she she says, against one another, and she insists on retaining both terms. So we've got mysterious and secular, unconscious and conscious, and even imagination and reality. And our poetry always needs both sides of these dyads. And the first of these terms, the mysterious, the unconscious, imagination, the fictive, tends to be associated with the non-representational. And I would argue that what Gray calls the liquidity of thought in the writing leaves the poem out of the real colonial environment it gestures at and into fictive textual spaces. What Guest means when she writes of ephemera that surround and decorate the mind of the poet, a halo rescued from life. Okay, so that's some spinning thought into a different space, which calls a fictive space, or a mysterious space, or mysterious another favourite word of hers. So such ephemera constitute the particular configurations of atmosphere that we recognise in Guest's work. Okay, talked all about dissolving. We're gonna moving through a temporal dissolve of 40 odd years. I want to look at the second of the Colonial Hours poem. And it's just poems. It's really striking that such different poems should choose exactly the same title for each of them. And it goes, slow moving and daybreak, an eyelash trembles, cat in mouse coat and thunder, the lane shivers, a branch falls as she listens. Weary of effervescence, twinkling languors knitted on the way to Princeton and Clayton, dark blue splashed, mud from early rains, bonjour to the Count, bonjour Benjamin Franklin. We memorised the court order, legalised the tunes, an odd evening, dark in the middle where the berries stood. The spinet was out of tune. It's a very Ashbury-esque ending, I think. The poem juxtaposes an isolated opening phrase with a block of 130-odd words. It begins at dawn, and the eye drops down the page as a figure wakes with an eyelash tremble. At the outset, there's a degree of temporal and spatial continuity, almost a scene that the waking woman might become aware of, or child might become aware of, its surroundings, thunder, a lane, a falling branch. Yet the rest of the poem derives from elsewhere. The phrase, bonjour Benjamin Franklin, Google tells me, is drawn from Franklin's correspondence with his French translator, Jacques Barbier Dubourg. So this is a friend that Franklin made in a couple of years spent in France raising support for American independence. So you could maybe at a pinch say that there's a kind of colonial element there buried in this arcane correspondence, possibly, but it feels a bit of a stretch. Some of the pertinences of the wealthy, the spinet, the phaeton, salvaged from the past, other aspects of the poem are more opaque. The cat in mouse coat, the pickling languors, the legalizations of tunes. How do we get from daybreak to evening in this poem? In the middle of what exactly do the berries stand? So perhaps Guest is thinking about the colonial in terms of the destruction of space, because the colonial involves violent incursions on the cultural imaginary. And the hours in the poem's title are subject to the upheaval of temporal warping. But where does the consistency of the text lie? And it's a really interesting question for Guest. Where does coherence, consistency lie? There are certain acoustic densities, shivers, listen, knitted, spinet, or thunder, languors, order, or even bonjour, Benjamin, or way to Princeton, Phaeton. This consistency may lie in acts of attention, listening, memorizing, or an unpleasant physical sensation, trembling, shivering, weariness. The poem's nearest gestures at a structured world are to court order, or legalizing the tunes, whatever that means. It's the current stuff going on about copyright. I don't know what she's going out with legalizing the tunes. But it ends out of joint with the out-of-tune spinet. So hence my suggestion of texture as a way of conceiving abstraction in Guest's writing. The interweaving of disparate elements yields poems that feel cohesive despite their variousness. The writing gestures at determinate times and spaces, but these dissolve. Their residue is shaping the atmosphere within which each poem subsists. In the case of this strange poem, my speculation is that she's free-associating around a childhood memory of waking at dawn. It's colonial in that Florida has that resonance for her. both in its proximity to the Caribbean and in its own history of settlement and expropriation, being the first part of the US to be permanently settled by Europeans. For Charles Altieri, guest writing exhibits a painterly lack of boundaries between the component parts of the poem and this is comparable to non-representational painting. This lack of boundaries pushes the, quote, differential logic of words towards the continuous complete space of painterly composition. And this is helpful as a way of characterizing an acknowledged debt of guests to abstract painting, but of course she was also interested in representational painting. However, I'm not sure in the end what purchase this idea of 2D painterly space can have on text. Guest poems, after all, are consolatory arrangements that inhabit many times many spaces. The arcane psychic geography that these poems open up poses linguistic abstraction, not as a transplantation of unboundary painterly continuity, but as a meshing of disparate strands. Atmosphere stands over and above the poems pushed to abstraction. The two colonial hours poems fashion atmospheres that survive the destruction of spatiotemporal continuities. Barbara Guest's exploration of the colonial is characteristically cagey and idiosyncratic. If at times it offers a languorous world of ceiling fans, palm trees, and exotic birds, it offers it as a trope that is vulnerable to destruction, as vulnerable to destruction as anything else in the poetry. The writer points to the fragility of such cultural moments. The finely calibrated attunement to atmosphere in the writing is comparable to what Catherine Stewart describes as chronicling how incommensurate elements hang together in the scene. This generous, capacious mode of attention sits at a very distant remove from the inheritance of the colonial plantation. Thanks.